So, I think what is the actual title given in the schedule? Something like quantum cavities or cavities in quantum mechanics or something to do with cavities?
Just cavities.
Just cavities. Let's see. I think I took that as inspiration to, I'm not going to, present a talk of latest research results. I think this is a school, and so I wanted to give a lecture that I think summarized for me a particular trajectory of my own thinking about these problems in searches for ultralight dark matter, these kind of tabletop experiments, in particular, the search for ultralight dark matter of the type, the sort of QCD axion style searches. This is sort of like not an area that I grew up doing research in as a graduate student, as a postdoc. It's kind of a late, later activity for me. And in that time, I had a little experience sort of interpreting the pictures of the experiments, the diagrams that would appear. And at times they weren't as helpful as they could have been. So what I'd really like to do in the first lecture is develop a model for these ultralight dark matter searches, which is something that to which you can then use or think about the field of quantum enhanced sensing as a way to sort of make work better or faster. And in particular, what I'm going to do in the lecture today is develop a quantum mechanical model, kind of a quantum optics flavored model for these kind of experiments that's going to be the machinery that allows us to calculate things. And in particular, the stuff that gets closer to my own research is how to use quantum enhanced sensing to make those searches go faster. Okay. What I've done to start with is just written down a few citations to papers that you can find on the archive. The first one is the big quantum noise review from Clerk, Gervin, Devaray, and Sholkhoff. If you look in the appendices of that paper, C and D, they include the quantization of transmission lines. That's kind of an important piece of machinery. I won't do that with any rigor, but it'll sort of, kind of walk into the same room with that derivation, make friends with it, and use some of the results. If you want to see it done with rigor, that can be found there. I lectured on this topic at the Lesueur Summer School in 2019. The notes are now finally published for that, and you can find them here, the second thing. And then the third link is to kind of an experiment that is a demonstration of the quantum enhanced sensing in this world. Not the actual dark matter search itself, but a kind of demonstration experiment that we did in my group, where in particular in the appendices of that paper, we kind of go through the machinery of these calculations as well. So if in the end my lecture is too clumsy and rambling and you grow weary of it, you can always find the content of the lecture basically in those three places. Good. The goal for lecture one today is really to develop this quantum optics model through equations of motion and thinking about kind of frequency dependent susceptibilities. So all of this happens in this context of ultralight dark matter. I feel embarrassed, frankly, coming to the Perimeter Institute and talking about this. I largely, what I know about the topic, I've largely learned from people in the audience rather than the other way around. Nevertheless, I'll try to give my quick summary. As I understand it, for lots and lots of good reasons, we think that dark matter is composed of some fundamental particle that isn't part of the standard model. Other than that, what do we know about dark matter? Well, it should be weakly interacting because we haven't detected it terrestrially. So anything which would sort of be easy to detect, we would have detected. It's sort of cold now and cold in early enough in the universe to allow large scale structure to develop. And I interpret that to mean roughly that the velocity distribution of whatever these dark matter particles are is kind of in some sort of virialized equilibrium with us and we with it. And that means it's sort of moving around at something like 300 kilometers per second, or about one part per thousand the speed of light. And then we know something about its energy density locally now to be something like 0.3 to 0.5 GeV per cubic centimeter. All right. People who know this topic, any lies detected? No one's going to say you've got something wrong by a few orders of magnitude. Good. All right. So if the rest mass energy of these particles is less than about 30 electron volts, that is enough information to say that, well, at least if these are composed of really a single flavor of particle, that essentially it has to be bosonic, because if it were fermionic, then the Fermi velocity would be too large to be kind of gravitationally bound. That's for the QCD axion, that is to say, I read in papers, I don't know that I fully understand the claim, that the rest mass energy is bounded by observation to be less than about 2 millielectron volts. So really, and that's much, much less than something like 30 EV, which would be the rest mass energy that you would need for the de Broglie wavelength of these particles to start to overlap and to be a quantum gas. So this would be, for the QCD axion, you're definitely deeply in a quantum degenerate gas, a Bose condensed state. And in particular, like if you were to have some 1 liter apparatus in your lab, the density of particles or the number of particles in that apparatus is some number much bigger than one, 10 to the 15, 10 to the 20. It's a gigantic number. And then finally, the reason that I stand before you is the Lagrangian of the universe in its low energy limit, I guess, has some term in it that looks like the axion field coupled to this pseudoscalar combination of electric and magnetic fields. I'm putting hats on things. Maybe I'll put little vector symbols on E and B as well. I'm putting hats on things not so much to decorate them with quantum mechanics, but just to remind me which things are the dynamical variables. So if you are interested in testing the hypothesis that the dark matter is made up of axions, and in particular these kind of QCD axions, are interested, well, in looking for that axion field to sort of couple to electromagnetism in some way. I guess in some sort of suspicious Feynman diagram, suspicious in the sense that I can't calculate anything in this language. you can imagine that there's some process by which axions decay into photons or are coupled to photons. But I look at this as kind of a quantum engineer and say, I'm just going to linearize this interaction around the biggest static magnetic field that I can make. And then I will have some kind of resonant conversion of the axion field into photons. And in particular, if the apparatus that I'm using to look for these is essentially at rest with respect to the dark matter, then you're looking for photons, microwave, well, photons whose energy is the rest mass energy of these particles. And that's in something like, well, something less than 500 gigahertz. So all right. Is all of that incredibly familiar? Yeah, it's like, you know, good. So roughly speaking, you build some apparatus that couples to dark matter, and you look for microwave or lower energy photons, energy that isn't supposed to be there. That problem, like the detecting of microwave radiation, which would be surprising to be there, is a thing that's sort of the experimental world that I live in. So let us. Okay, so how do you do that? The concept that's existed, I think, now for 20 years, or sorry, 40 years, really since about 1983, was this idea of Pierre Secchi's to build a microwave cavity, like a right circular cylinder of metal, empty inside, stick it in the biggest static magnetic field that you can get, and then build some kind of electrical measurement apparatus that measures the presence or absence of microwave fields inside of that cavity. And in particular, I guess if I were to complete the picture that you would see in a kind of popularization of the topic, there'd be an axion field coming in here, something called a sea of virtual photons associated with the magnetic field, and then a real photon that would come out to be detected by some kind of electrical measurement apparatus. And the output of that is, in electrical units would be some voltage as a function of time, which you would then Fourier transform. Look at the power spectral density, the kind of spectral content, the frequency content in the noise. Centered at the cavity's frequency. And then you would hope to see in that noise a little peak, a little bit of excess microwave power, a little bit of excess electrical energy at some frequency, which would be your axion frequency, And it would have some characteristic line width about a part in 10 to the 6 of this central frequency. That's from essentially that part per thousand speed of light. And the width over which you would look for that would be something like the cavity's frequency divided by its quality factor, some kind of characteristic line width of that cavity. And then finally, what you will read is that this little triangle here, this electrical measuring device, its properties, its important properties, is characterized by some noise that it introduces, usually specified as some temperature. It's got some, and that temperature is nothing but the photon energy near the frequency that it is looking, expressed in thermal units. That's the way microwave engineers, oh, sorry. It is bounded by that, bigger than that number. This picture is, in a very real sense, wrong. It's really wrong. It's wrong in the sense that I think it is misleading about how you should think about the experiments. It does not capture correctly where noise comes from and what you can do about it. And there's really a better picture to draw. And that's better picture is a little bit of the message of this lecture. So, what's wrong with the picture? First, it really invites you to think of the detection of this kind of dark matter as some kind of rare scattering event, that there's some very dilute gas of these axion particles. Every once in a while, one flies into your cavity and scatters into a photon, and every once in a while, that photon is detected. If you would think just about, like, what would such a signal look like, it would not give you a narrow, coherent peak in frequency. Why is this a narrow, coherent peak? Well, if I'm in some Bose-condensed state, in some phase-coherent state of this condensed field, there's a well-defined phase, and it is oscillating with some frequency associated with that rest mass. And so, rare events that sort of where a photon would pop briefly into an existence and be detected every once in a while, that would not produce a little spectrally narrow signal like that. In addition, it assigns all of the imperfection in the experiment, all of this, whatever background of fluctuation that you are measuring, trying to detect the presence of some signal on top of the background of this experiment, isn't assigned to this little triangle here. As we'll see, that's really not correct. Furthermore, it's really not clear how I should think about the action of this triangle. It seems to sort of like only be extracting things from the cavity. It's sort of unclear if it's sending anything down in. And in any kind of electrical measurement, usually you worry about maybe my electrical measuring apparatus injects noise out of its input. If you haven't had the misfortune of fretting about the input noise of your amplifier, well, I can assure you that's a thing. And this is kind of unclear in this picture. It just seems to be just sort of connected in some mysterious way to this cavity. So maybe it's fairer to say that that picture is Okay. So, the rare scattering of particles, the fact that it's not like that, I think that's a deficiency of this picture. But the rest of what I'm going to tell you about is maybe this kind of notion of we're just going to get this amplifier, it's going to have this property and it's going to have this bound, and we'll just get the best we can and live with it. That was kind of fine. That was sort of 40 years ago when this concept was developed. That was a perfectly valid way to think. Stuff has happened in 40 years. So if you think about what the sort of sensitivity of an experiment like this is controlled by, the things that you kind of you can't change the dark matter density or its coupling to electromagnetism. So if you were to say, let's think about the power spectral density in the signal, basically something like how high this peak is over this power spectral density in the noise. Say equal proportional to well, what are you going to do to make the signal bigger or the noise smaller? You can always make a bigger magnetic field, and that actually helps a lot. We're not much better at making big magnets now than we were 40 years ago. Like, there's not been some huge revolution in magnet technology. The V is the volume of the cavity. That's actually tied to the frequency that you're looking at, right? The resonance frequency of this cavity is basically controlled by fitting a half wavelength of the electromagnetic mode into that right circular cylinder. You don't have much flexibility on that. Q is quality factor of the cavity, basically how many times it rings before it loses a characteristic amount of energy. It's made of copper. Copper isn't better now than it is 40 years ago. What's changed is the measuring part of this thing. That's really different now. The world of people trying to build quantum computers out of superconducting circuits has changed that world. There's more possible now than there used to be. And that's the place where you can make some progress. And that's why a better picture is important. So, let me draw what I think is a better picture. And then we'll keep the right circular cylinder, the metal box that has electromagnetic resonant modes. One of them is coupled to your dark matter. You have a penetration into the cavity. Out comes a transmission line. We'll extend this picture in a moment. That's where we'll start. Oh my God, there's horrible radio engineering symbols there. We know what the hell is this thing? They're resistors. This is the right picture, though. It's really the right picture. It's the right picture. It's going to allow us to write down meaningful equations of motion that you can calculate sensitivity. You can think clearly about how you do quantum enhanced sensing in this world. So, what's better about this picture? Well, that's the symbol essentially for some oscillatory microwave generator. That makes a little narrow peak in a noise spectrum. That's a better model for the dark matter. Calculating how big a signal you would like to attribute to this, how that's sort of all of the physics of the dark matter itself, the fact that it's very weakly coupled to your cavity, but the fact that it's a narrow band coherent signal, That's much better represented by that symbol. This is ultimately an electrical measurement. So we'll capture that with an electrical symbol. Resistors. Why, you know, what are these resistors doing there? If nothing else, you should associate the resistor with dissipation, with the fact that that's some kind of loss. And loss will be tied to fluctuations. Fluctuation and dissipation theorem, there's a lecture on it tomorrow, I believe. And so if you want to think about where noise comes from, what is really the origin of this background density of noise, having a thing that you can point to and say, oh, it comes from there, and notice now that the kind of there's this terrible thing. There's some little object with an arrow in it. That is a microwave circulator. It is an object that takes microwave fields that enter it and directs it to the port as indicated by this, the direction of that arrow. So it means that fields that are exiting the cavity get directed over here to the measurement, just a half a second. And then fields that are incident on the cavity come from this resistor. And separating those two things is sort of important. Go ahead, Mia. No, actually, we can add in the intrinsic cavity loss. Let's do that. I was going to kind of do that in another step in the lecture, but that's fine. So why did I draw a resistor there? Good. As a matter of principle, you will probably never succeed in doing this in a real experiment. If you could imagine coupling so strongly the cavity to the axion field, that energy in the cavity would meaningfully decay by being converted into axions, that would be modeled by that resistor. This would be, you know, if I stuffed a bunch of photons into my microwave cavity, stuffed a bunch of energy in it, and I saw it disappearing someplace, and I was so good that I could get rid of every other piece of like intrinsic background dissipation, then I would be left with that. So I should draw that resistor. Or, and then what fluctuations do I, like, what fluctuation is that? Basically the thing that you really have no hope of measuring. Oh, okay. Why the little cylinders, or what are they? That's a symbol for a transmission line. Transmission line, oh God. What was your least favorite chapter of J.D. Jackson's textbook? Chapter 8, right? I think, oh God, it's waveguides. There's one page in that chapter, which contains, I think, the most like useful experimental fact, right? It tells you that if you have a metal cross-section object that is in cross-section separated into two or more conductors, there is a transverse electromagnetic mode that will propagate in that, and there's no cutoff at low frequencies, goes right down to DC. That in the those modes, electricity is scalar and one-dimensional. The solutions to the way, like the solutions to the electromagnetic modes in that are waves in one dimension. And there are left moving and right moving solutions. And so every little tube here, you should think of as having two classes of modes, those that move towards the cavity and those that move away from the cavity. And that's why I draw the little tubes. All right. So Let's go through it. So go ahead.
So the transmission lines, like your statement about two separate conductors there, that's like I should think of this as a coax cable or something
You
like
should
that.
think of it as a coaxial cable.
Okay, great, perfect, thank you.
If I cut this, so you usually don't draw the little sticking side, but hopefully most people were obliged at some point in their life to take some Horowitz and Hill-like course where they at least had to pull a coax cable off the wall. Many of you then, never went back, but that's right. You should think like coaxial cable.
I had one more question, which was it looks like you're at least as drawn, I don't see where the noise of the amplifier comes into this picture.
If you so desire, you can make this object noiseless.
Oh, okay.
So that's sort of like lecture two is we'll do that a little bit. But in principle, you can operate this amplifier in a way where it's bounded, not by this value, but by this value divided by two. And that's when you kind of measure both sine-like and cosine-like oscillations inside of that cable. Or if you just want to live with measuring one of those, then it doesn't have to add any noise. Doesn't mean there's no noise in the experiment. The noise, like, so you have a cavity. It is describable with a Hamiltonian, has unitary evolution, and your measurement will interrupt that unitary evolution. That's what's modeled by this. The fact that the act of measuring, of punching a hole in this cavity, letting microwave fields out, is going to alter the Hamiltonian evolution of the cavity. It's going to let add in both decay and like noise, and you can point to the origin of that noise. Okay, so this cable and this one, maybe I should have chosen a different color. Those are real. Like if you look in the real experiment, there are such cables. These two are a fiction, right? This one down here, designed to tell you about the fact that dark matter couples to your cavity. In principle, your cavity could lose energy to it. You don't have to worry very much about it because that's a weak coupling. Your only hope of detecting anything is that generator here, the density of dark matter coupled to your cavity. It's a gigantic number. That's a large amplitude generator, very, very weakly coupled with the cavity. And then finally, what's this one? This one is because you're not perfect. Your cavity will be lossy, the Q will be some finite number. That will carry with it decay. Energy can leave your cavity, get absorbed in the resistor. That resistor will also be a source of noise. So once you draw that picture, then you can, well, you can calculate.
Hello. So maybe if you're going to talk about this, then I can wait. But I've seen people, I'm a theorist, I've seen people draw these circulators before, and I have no conception of what that object is. Like physically, what does that look like? I don't really understand how you can talk about this one-way propagation around the circulator. Could you say a few words about that?
So I actually wasn't planning to talk about it in detail, but let's see why that such a thing is possible. It seems to violate kind of like expectations that things should be reciprocal, but they don't have to be. So in particular, I'll give you a clunky physical analogy. Imagine that I had a garden hose and I tied it into a loop and I had some fluid in that garden hose. And I could imagine gripping it in two spots, and then squeezing the hose in some coordinated way, right? Get the liquid to turn around one way, or you know, in the reverse order and get it to go around the other way. Using time-dependent modulation, it's possible, I think, pretty clearly to break time reversal symmetry. In quotations, because if you actually had a button that reversed time, you know, so your modulation would also invert. But from the perspective of the ports of a circulator, things look like they break time reversal symmetry. That means that if you inject a field from the bottom, it comes out of this port. And if you run that movie backwards in time, it does not do what you expect, right? If you run the movie backwards in time, then what would literally happen is this field would go back here. But if you actually were to inject a field this way, it would come out there. And that's the sense in which these objects break time reversal symmetry. So in reality, the commercial circulators that all of us use are based essentially on the Faraday effect. They use magnetism, which hides inside of it the fact that if you had a button that reversed time, you would also reverse the direction of magnetization inside of that object. I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer, but that's essentially the key to breaking non-reciprocity.
Are these active components then?
No, you can, like I have research activity in making things like that using active components, but they are completely passive objects when you buy them commercially based on the fact that they use, again, they use magnetism, basically the fact that if you could invert the arrow of time, or I don't know, the arrow of time, you invert time, you just take t to minus t, then all the little current loops would run the other way.
Sure.
And B would point the other way. And that breaks, basically breaks the electromagnetic response of the medium in there depends on the direction of magnetization. And that's basically how you break the reciprocity. Essentially, you build an object in which waves run around in a circle, and the speed of light is different in the two directions, in the two senses of circulation. That plus interference basically gives you a circulator.
This is really helpful. And I'm sorry for, you know,
oh, no. This is sort of the point.
The thing that I'm trying to understand is why do I consider this to be kind of a noiseless object and then the noise to come from this external resistor? I mean, the way people talk about this, intuitively, I get that I shouldn't be able to disconnect the other direction, but I don't, like, is there some simple theorem that I understand why there will always be noise introduced from the other port? Like, there must be some kind of time reversal possibility.
I mean, I think, like, in principle, you know, you could throw away the circulator, but then there is a general principle here, which is to say that if something can leave your cavity, something can enter it. And what leaves, right, is essentially electromagnetic modes, harmonic oscillator modes coupled to this cavity that run away and go this way. We don't want them to come back, right? We want them to run away and never come back. And so the modes that are propagating down the cable, where do they come from? You know, what determines their state? It's useful to have a picture of that, and that's here. And it's useful if they're determined by something that doesn't depend on the history of the cavity. I want things to leave the cavity and not come back. Unitarity is the basic principle. If you say, I would like to write down a completely unitary description of a system like this, like of a cavity, if I say, well, I can let the state of the cavity evolve into some field that's propagating up this cable. What determines the state of the cavity after that's happened? I need some unitary process. The thing that determines the state of the cavity after that's happened is whatever field is coming down. And there's a completely continuous in time, rigorous way to write down what happens. And then the circulator, all that's doing, in a way, is telling me, allowing me to have the fields that are coming from somewhere come from somewhere that I want and can control, not You know, that's just sort of, I could, without this circulator, a field could in principle leave, maybe bounce off the input of the amplifier and come back. If it's absorbed in the amplifier, then it's whatever, it's like, you know, it's essentially black body radiation in one dimension. If I say I throw radiation into a box and none of that is reflected, then there is a thermal contribution coming back out. In this case, it might be rather non-equilibrium because I have an active circuit that's making gain. That could make much more noise than just something describable as a low temperature.
So I can understand this as saying the temperature, the noise temperature, can be much lower than like the amplifier affected temperature.
Yeah, the physical so the noise temperature, you know, is purely a decision to describe like noise density in units of temperature, not for any reason more sophisticated than if you were a microwave engineer in the 1960s and you wanted to know how noisy your amplifier was, you would take a resistor and you put it at its input and you would heat it up and cool it down. And you know, that's why it's in temperature units for the same reason that measure pressure in millimeters of mercury. You probably don't do that, but you know, that's kind of why that unit exists, because that's the apparatus that you use to determine that quantity. Okay. Good. So, that's my bad picture. Let's get rid of that. So, what we want to do is write down some description of that cavity. You know, those symbols carry with them equations that you can solve, and you can decide that you wish to modify things based on your solutions. So look, let's write down the Hamiltonian of our cavity, or more to the point, the one mode in that cavity that couples to our axion field. We'll name the creation and annihilation operators, B and B dagger, because we used A for the axion. And this combination B dagger B, that's just the photon number operator. And I'm going to kind of work in a Heisenberg picture and say, I can just write down my equation of motion for my annihilation operator, solve that, what's missing here, right, is any thing which is nothing to do with any of these resistors, anything with to do with this axion field. What's the way to kind of understand like why this picture is useful is allows you now to organize your thinking about where the non-unitary processes come from and what causes them. So in particular, let's deal first with this stuff. So we're going to modify this equation of motion so that it includes the Hamiltonian evolution plus something that models decay. That's the field leaving the cavity, and then something that models the field's incident on the cavity. So this will be down. So kappa m is a decay rate. It's just telling me, look, classically, energy is going to leave my cavity via its coupling to this transmission line at some characteristic rate, kappa m. Because by longstanding convention, you specify the energy decay rate when you as kappa m, then when you want to talk about how quickly the fields decay, it's kappa m over 2. Why has that one got a square root? Let's do that in a moment. Okay, good. So this part of the equation of motion of my cavity field is just telling me about Hamiltonian evolution and decay. And then this piece is like the associated fluctuations that are coming from this port that I've opened up in the cavity. And so the really question is kind of, what are these things? So in rigor derived with some, you know, like reasonable, I think theorist friendly language in these two appendices. But if you like, if I wanted, so I won't derive this. I'm going to wave my hands, literally, maybe loop, draw them in loops. Imagine that I took a coax cable and I just kind of wound it in a big loop. So it just kind of closed on itself. This is a structure that supports one-dimensional waves that run around either clockwise or counterclockwise. And because I made it finite in length, there's going to be a discrete spectrum of those running modes. Label each and every one of them by some k index that sort of counts the number of waves inside of the loop. Those are harmonic oscillator solutions to that structure. They have a frequency. You can write down creation and annihilation operators for each of them. Now imagine that I want to pile up, well, first let's take the length large. So I get a nice dense spectrum. And then I want to say have something like a wave packet. So I pile up some linear combination of those spectral modes to make a little temporal wave packet, something which is short in time. It's now a linear combination of harmonic oscillator modes. In my way of thinking about it, another harmonic oscillator, this one specified as some little wave packet running through a transmission line. These objects here, mathematically what they are, like what's the T that appears in that? You should imagine some little wave packet running through the transmission line. And T is the incident in is the instant in time at which it will reach the port on my cavity. And so you should imagine that in some sense, this resistor is tossing little harmonic oscillators at the cavity. Scattering from the cavity changes that will be altered by scattering from the cavity. And then they're going to leave to be detected, where I can then measure properties of those harmonic oscillator modes that I've scattered off of the cavity and make inferences of what happened because they scattered off the cavity. So we need an equation. Oh, so dimensionally, if I were to do kind of B dagger B for these, instead of getting number, I get number per second. They're not energy, they're power. And that's basically the way that, you know, when you take the dense spectrum, you don't get a discrete number of modes, you go to a continuum. And these now, so they're annoying Dirac delta functions, which as an experimentalist I always hate. But so be it. I'm the one pitching this to you, so I shouldn't complain too much. Good. Right. So how do the output fields depend on the input fields. Well, in two ways. First, promptly reflected, plus dependent on what's already inside the cavity. So these two equations, let's see. Good. Yep. Make sure. This is an expression where it's acceptable to make an even number of sign errors, but you should not make an odd number. Okay, good. So if you like, this equation determines the evolution of the cavity field under both the action of the boring Hamiltonian thing, the decay, and then whatever field is being injected, and then the field leaving the cavity, going up this way, depends on the incident field plus the field that's in the cavity. So again, well,
this is not fluid. That's your signal, right? B hat is your signal.
What is the signal? So this is not noise, but if you think there's field in the cavity, describable as like the square root of a photon number, it doesn't create number, it creates power. In other words, it's saying that if I store energy in the cavity and I let it leak out, I will describe the leaking out as a certain photon number per second. And so, like, I think dimensionally it has to be. But in addition, like, if you think about it, this is square root of number per second, square root of number per second, and then square root of number per square root of second. And so just telling you that if I want to think about the field leaving the cavity, in the cavity there will be some energy, and then the what's coming out of the cable I will describe as some power. So we think of this as being describing somehow the quantum state of the incoming microwave field traveling down this transmission line, and this piece as describing the quantum state of the outgoing field. I will just mention the thing that probably some of you have anticipated, that if I were to write just as for B and B dagger itself, these input and output modes, I'll just write it for the inputs. Where I'm thinking of them first as time-dependent quantities, they have the, well, I should write the arguments. I'm going to do that. They have the kind of continuous in time commutation relationship that you'd expect for bosonic creation and annihilation operators. And so all right. Of course. Oh. Yeah.
I think we have like roughly 5-ish minutes left.
I should. So let's see. I have me as about having about 5 more minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Go ahead.
So is there some simple Hamiltonian that this B out, B in, and B are supposed to be coupled by that you're getting these equations from, or is this just empirical?
Yeah, so like just kind of like written down from whole cloth here, but if you wanted to derive this, what you would have is a set of weakly coupled oscillators describing the state of the cable, and then coupled in some linear way to the one harmonic oscillator in the cavity. That kind of weak coupling term would end up kind of giving you something that you end up calling kappa in this way.
Thank you.
Well, looks like a question behind you.
What's the index M? The index M on these?
So eventually we will have a decoration on this port and a decoration on this port. This one will get kappa L for loss and kappa A for axion.
Thanks.
All right. So the only modification we'll make to this story, just to kind of allow us to describe the statistical properties of these input and output fields, is to work in a rotating frame. So basically, this Hamiltonian evolution, kind of boring, you know, sort of a nuisance to keep track of it. And in particular, if we work in a range, you know, if we say, okay, these are in principle time-dependent things that are sort of infinitesimal in time and infinite in frequency as a consequence. Nevertheless, if we're able to sort of work in a range of frequencies where the range of frequencies is broad compared to the line width of the cavity, compared to, say, kappa m, but nevertheless narrow compared to the overall resonance frequency, we can make our life a little simpler when we think about the statistical properties of these noise operators. And so to do that, I'm just going to modify the equations of motion, and I'll do that in the following way. We're going to imagine that I'm going to take B, and I'll just, you know, I'll transform it everywhere I see B. I'll just replace it with E to the minus I omega C T. And then in doing so, what I will do is lose this piece. I will And then I understand that I'm also transforming the input and output operators in the same way. So we're working in a rotating frame for them as well. And then these are the so-called Heisenberg-Langevin equations of motion in the rotating frame of the cavity. So in other words, the fields are understood to have any time evolution just associated with that kind of Hamiltonian evolution of the cavity mode. That's sort of taken out. And it's any difference from that. So in particular, like the decay. From these, all right. So we want to stop, I think, kind of in like 2 minutes, right? That's what I have. I have this 58. Okay. I hope to get through half a page more, but I think instead of doing that, maybe I'll just, this was boxing those equations was most of the goal of today. Maybe I'll just stop for questions then.
More questions?
The box is behind you.
Huh?
So I have a question about the circulator.
Go ahead.
And you know, one thing you could do is say, oh, instead of a circulator, I'm just going to put a beam splitter.
I could what?
You could use a beam splitter.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And then, you know, take this factor of two hit, but you inject, let's say, more vacuum noise. Does that totally screw up what happens, you know, tomorrow potentially, or does it just degrade by some, you know, square to two or?
It wouldn't, like, if you really, really would like to say, I want the cavity field coming down towards the cavity, not to have really much of the amplifier's back action, you might need more than just a 50-50 beam splitter. You might need a quite asymmetric beam splitter. In which case, what you would do is, well, all right, you've brought up beam splitters. Let's get rid of my circulator. And we're going to switch from microwave engineering symbols to, you know, optics symbols, oh God. And what you're saying is I could imagine taking the field coming out of the cavity, directing it to the amplifier by bouncing it off of some not very shiny mirror. And then most of the signal, most of the delicious signal that you wanted will then run away and never come back. And what will come in through this port is more whatever is determining the statistical properties of this, which if it's nothing else is going to be vacuum noise itself. So yeah, you will actually have suffered a lot when you did that, because most of the, like, you will have diluted the signal that you wanted to measure and replaced it with vacuum, and that's going to add a lot of noise. So yes, the circulator is the better strategy.
Okay, let's send Conrad again.